Hello, I'm Kate Chabot with an extra edition of the SITREP podcast from BFBS. 50 years ago, the army was more than twice its current size, much of it based in West Germany. The operational focus was in Northern Ireland, where soldiers faced gunfire and explosions as they travelled in Land Rovers. It's easy to see how much has changed over that half century, but understanding that change and its effects requires a step back and, in the words of my guest, joining the dots. Brigadier Ben Barry's new book, The Rise and Fall of the British Army, 1975 to 2025, tells the stories of that half century. The operations and exercises, the military and political decisions, the successes and failures. All with the aim of understanding the lessons to help us prepare for the next 50 years.
This is SITREP
from BFBS.
Ben Barry, great to see you on SITREP. Thank you for joining us again. Can you just start by very briefly explaining the title of your book and why you wanted to write it?
Well, the title is The Rise and Fall of the British Army, 1975 to 2025. So it's 50 years, and it includes the army that I served in and have also continued to help after I retired. It is a story of rise. So we get the army greatly improving its combat capabilities from the mid-70s to 1990 under the decisive leadership of General Bagnall. It's then tested in a very unforeseen way on Operation Granby, where it performs brilliantly on an utterly unexpected charge with many combat and logistic challenges. But there's then a sort of plateau, and the plateau is the New World Disorder, which includes Bosnia, Kosovo, Sierra Leone, 9/11. And the army does jolly well on all those operations, often in very difficult circumstances, which I saw for myself in Bosnia and Kosovo. But it relies on the sort of baseline laid down in the Cold War. It's also an army of 100,000 during the 1990s, which enables it to do all these things and keep Northern Ireland going. But then we get, after a very successful initial attack on Basra in 2003, we get yet more defence cuts, cumulative defence cuts, including a secret defence review I describe in the book. And we also get the army grappling with two big problems. One big problem is that the war is unpopular, and that's something the army's never had to fight before during the time frame in this book. And secondly, capability keeps being cut and sliced away, not just by the unsympathetic Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown, but then by the following coalition and conservative government. So the fall, the decline from this high plateau of achievement is one of ever-reducing capability and money, and also some botched equipment programs. The army also becomes the least modernized of the three armed services, with the highest proportion of obsolete equipment. And if you like, the chickens come home to roost in 2022 when Russia attacks Ukraine, because it suddenly becomes obvious to the government that the army would have great difficulty sending a substantial combat force to fight in Eastern Europe. The reason I wrote it is, A, I thought it was a story worth telling, but in the aftermath of Ukraine, it became quite clear to me that there were some aspects of the Cold War forward defence, you know, a corps sitting on the East German border, and many of the tactical and equipment problems of the Cold War seemed to me to be directly relevant to the army's requirement to do forward defence of Estonia, and also now this new requirement coming from the SDR to provide a strategic reserve corps that can go anywhere in Europe very, very quickly. And what I felt was, although there were lots of senior officers who sort of acknowledged the Cold War and particularly the transformation made by General Bagnall, but it wasn't clear for me to me that they understood the substance behind it. So I felt I should fill that gap.
And that high point, the high plateau you talked about between 1990 and 2003, in terms of military achievement, what was it about that period, do you think?
I mean, what it showed was that the army had great foundations. It had good equipment, by and large, a proportion of which had been modernised in the Cold War and then continued to be modernised, with also some new equipment coming into service, like the Apache helicopter. It also had a great way of selecting and training people, both officers and soldiers, and right across the combat arms, the support arms, such as the engineers and the gunners, and also the logistic corps, which of course had merged into a new Royal Logistic Corps, which seems to have been a tremendous success. It had also transformed in the Cold War its way of thinking about combat. Initially in the Cold War, it had quite an attritional, old-fashioned approach. But General Bagnall led this revolution of military thinking, which emphasised manoeuvre warfare and the operational level of war. And he also set up the Higher Command and Staff Corps to better educate the senior leaders of the army and all three services. So it had very strong foundations. And when it was faced with unexpected challenges, because Bosnia was something that was completely unanticipated, Kosovo, there was a little more warning, but it was still extremely difficult. And then Sierra Leone, Afghanistan in 2001, setting up the ISAF initially, and also taking down Basra in 2003, which it did through a very 21st century smart siege that kicked Saddam's forces out but didn't trash the city. That was all built on really strong foundations of people, of training, of equipment, and also the conceptual component of fighting power, how the army thought about things. I do say in the book, though, that the successes against all these unexpected scenarios between 1990 and 2003 may well have led to a degree of complacency and comfortableness, some of which was exposed by difficulties in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And you were serving for more than half of the period covered in the book. How much of what you wrote about did you have hands-on experience with?
Well, I served for 35 years, which is 70% of the book. Well, I did my turn in Northern Ireland. I did my turn in Bosnia. I was lucky enough also to take part in the final wave of big formation Cold War exercises, including Exercise Lionheart 84, the largest exercise of that period, where a whole corps was deployed into the field, over 130,000 troops. It included 12,000 NATO troops, 12,000 members of the Royal Air Force, but three whole British divisions. The lines of communication activated. The exercise box ran from Ostend all the way to 10 miles from the inner German border. And it was not only exciting, but real efforts have been made to make it unpredictable and allow free play. For example, the brigade I was in, the headquarters was destroyed by a raiding party of paratroops. So one of the battalions had to step up. Similarly, at one stage in the exercise, 4th Armoured Brigade was destroyed because the enemy unexpectedly counterattacked it. And there was a lot of friction and a lot of challenge, which I saw for myself. And I think one of the weaknesses that the resource crunch after the end of the war in Afghanistan imposed on the army is it hasn't exercised at that level since. It's only just restored doing proper brigade exercises, for example.
And you set out to identify failures and successes for the army in those 50 years. If we start with the positive, you've already mentioned Op Granby. What are some of the other successes?
Operationally, Bosnia was a great success. It's very easy to forget just how challenging Bosnia was. And in mid-1995, for example, it was in a state of almost permanent crisis. It wasn't clear how the mission would proceed, whether it might have to withdraw under fire. And Britain and France had both played a leading role in holding the UN together in Bosnia. And John Major played a leading role in trying to straighten things out after a particular crisis, where he personally chaired a conference at Lancaster House. And an outstanding role, I think, was played by the then UN commander in Sarajevo, General Sir Rupert Smith, who deserves a share of a Nobel Peace Prize for helping to bring the war to an end, which, you know, if there had been justice, it should have been shared between him and the US diplomat Richard Holbrook, who negotiated the end to the war. But battalions and regiments had very, very difficult times For example, when the fighting was high in central Bosnia, in the Royal Welsh, in the enclave in Garajda, which was very difficult, the artillery on Mount Igman, taking part in the combined shelling and airstrikes that eventually ended the war. And, you know, all of that was the army going into very difficult and unknown territory. You then get Kosovo, which becomes very difficult because of while the force is waiting to go in because of the difficulties of the NATO air campaign. And also, at a very difficult point, the NATO commander, General Clark, orders General Jackson to confront Russian paratroops at Pristina Airport. And General Jackson judges that this carries high potential of turning violent and starting World War III. And Jackson refuses to carry out the order, and it's backed up by General Guthrie. I think the final place where you've got an equal level of difficulty is Sierra Leone, where an initial small evacuation operation of some SAS and the parachute regiment go in under command of Brigadier David Richards to do an evacuation. But Richards, who knows Sierra Leone very well, sees that there's an opportunity there to help stiffen a failing UN mission and administer a bloody nose to the rebels who are advancing on the capital and threatening the government. And in doing so, he takes personal and political risk, but it comes off brilliantly. And then Britain plays a really important role in building the Sierra Leone army over the following decade. And we see the value of this, actually, in 2014, when there's the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, and an army-led joint task force, including civilians from the NHS, is deployed to Sierra Leone. Now, the expert epidemiologists back in the UK are saying, it's lost. You can't turn this disease round. The outbreak's under control. But the joint task force, led by the army and with a lot of army in it, manages to do so in part because it mobilises the Sierra Leone army, who perform brilliantly because of the way their capabilities been built since the 2000 intervention. So those are all really good examples of operational success built on those foundations I described before.
And what about the failures during those 50 years? History records Iraq and Afghanistan as failures for the UK and the US, but is it fair to describe them as failures for the army? Because arguably they did successfully what they were asked to do. It was the people who were doing the asking that failed to get it right.
Well, the mitigating circumstance is that whilst Tony Blair did exactly what was required of a prime minister in terms of providing leadership for the attack on Basra in 2003, and that's very clear from the Iraq inquiry, what the inquiry also shows is that Blair's leadership of the stabilisation was inadequate. I mean, I'd go as far to say as times that it was incompetent. And the Iraq inquiry lays this out in excruciating details. And I pick some examples. For example, in 2003, after a visit to Iraq, where Blair correctly discerns that things aren't going well, he says to the cabinet, we've got to put the government on a war footing. And he actually declares that he's going to do that to President Bush in a video conference. But no substantive action is taken to put the government on a war footing. And there are many occasions on which Blair decides that something needed to be done, but seems incapable of making it happen. You know, he's just displays a low level of competence in getting stuff done in stabilisation. You've also got the unsympathetic Chancellor, Gordon Brown, who doesn't make it easy for money to be spent on Iraq and Afghanistan. But it's quite clear to me, and I saw this for myself when I wrote the Army's final operational lessons study of Iraq, that the army itself could have moved faster. It could have been less bureaucratic and it could have moved faster to bend itself out of shape. And again, the Iraq inquiry lays out that there were unacceptable delays in the procurement of protected patrol vehicles for both Iraq and Afghanistan. And I'm afraid the same sentiment applies to Afghanistan. Although in 2008, General David Richards, who we've talked about previously as Brigadier David Richards in Sierra Leone, as commander-in-chief, he decides more urgency is needed and he puts land command initially, then the army on a campaign footing to prioritise Afghanistan over everything else, Operation Entirety. And that seemed to apply the necessary energy. Although one thing I became aware of when I was writing the book is there were many, many officers in the army at the time who worked, for example, in army headquarters, who felt that Operation Entirety had itself so bent the army out of shape that it made it difficult for it to reconcentrate on war fighting. And certainly the army didn't go back to Cold War level of exercising after Afghanistan as quickly as the US Army did, for example.
And as well as operations, you also cover important exercises and some operations that were planned and rehearsed but never actually conducted. Can you just tell us about one or two of those?
I mean, one thing about the exercises, and we did talk about Exercise Lionheart earlier, is the scale of the troops deployed on them produced lessons. So, for example, every year there wasn't a core exercise in Germany. There was a divisional exercise. And several other brigades would exercise as well, often with other armies. So equipment and people and plans were being tested, and they were constantly being revised. So an example I talk about in there is the Quiet Revolution in logistics, because what these exercises and logistic exercises showed is that the ammunition and mines couldn't be outloaded quickly enough from the depots and the bunkers and couldn't be moved quickly enough to where it was needed, particularly gun lines and engineer squadrons laying minefields. And that gave rise to redesigning the bunkers and procuring new equipment, particularly the drops lorry, which was then a fantastic success in Operation Granby and the Balkans. And when you've got this high level of exercising, you're constantly exercising the muscles and you're learning lessons. I mean, this is why rugby teams train so much. They're constantly learning and refining. You asked about the operations that didn't happen. Two come to mind. The first one, which has been covered, was the planned SAS raid on Argentina during the Falklands War, where, of course, the reconnaissance party got in but was dropped in the wrong place. And so the ambitious plan to land on an Argentine airfield where there were thought to be Exocet missiles and kill all the Argentine servicemen there and destroy the missiles, that never happened. And I actually come to the conclusion that it's a good thing it never happened. And the reason it's a good thing, because it would have been seen as an outrage, not only in Argentina, but in Latin America as a whole, and could have shifted the balance against the UK in the United Nations in New York. That's not dissing, you know, the considerable effort that was put into this by the SAS and also the RAF and the Royal Navy. But in the balance of things, mounting it, I think, would have been a military success, but a political mistake. The other operation I talk about that's less well known is something known as Operation Haymarket or Operation Screwdriver. And this was at the height of the Bosnian War when the British garrison in Garajda was isolated, cut off, threatened by the Bosnian Serbs, and in quite desperate conditions. It was surviving, of course, through the cohesion of the Royal Welsh and, you know, excellent leadership, but it was in a very difficult position. So a plan was evolved to get them out by air, which would have involved a lot of SAS, a parachute battalion, lots of RAF helicopters, and active flights by fast jets to suppress Bosnian Serb air defences. And this was actually rehearsed twice in the UK, but it was a sort of prototype challenging joint operation where you saw conventional forces, air forces and the SAS and the army, the conventional army, all operating together, which, of course, they had to do later in both Sierra Leone and quite often in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think both those operations that never happened but were planned yield important lessons themselves.
And so having brought this history of the last 50 years of the army together, what are the most important takeaways for the army to turn around from fall to rise to face the threats we face now and in the coming years?
Well, there's a lot of good language in the Strategic Defence Review about what needs to be done. But of course, the target in the Strategic Defence Review of a rapid strategic reserve corps of two divisions against an army of 75,000, an army reserve of 30,000, is very demanding, particularly because the army is at a very low state of readiness. It doesn't appear to have enough ammunition, enough combat supplies. I think it's not doing enough training. And also, the medical services of all three armed forces are not capable of fulfilling their operational role. And both the MODs admitted that, and the House of Commons Defence Committee shone light on it a year ago. So there's got to be, the army could fight tonight, but it would find it quite difficult, and it would take longer than it would like to achieve its missions, and it would probably suffer far more casualties. So that needs restoring urgently. So it needs rapid spending on all those unglamorous but essential commodities like ammunition, spare parts, you know, the stuff that needs to fill the logistic depots, which my sense is have more empty shelves than full shelves at the moment. And of course, it's been exacerbated by gifting so much army equipment to Ukraine. But restoring this ability to fight tonight, we can't wait for the decade that the SDR says is going to be needed to deliver this high-tech integrated force. I think we should aim to do it in about 3 years. And the clear and present danger is those estimates that have been stated in public by the NATO Secretary General and a number of European intelligence agencies, that if the war in Ukraine ends tomorrow, within 5 years, Russia could have rebuilt sufficient conventional capability to pose a serious threat to NATO. So in my judgment, the government and the army have got to get a move on in rebuilding this essential combat readiness.
And you state very clearly you didn't want to turn it into an autobiography, but I wonder how it felt to be critically analysing major operations in which you played a part and which played a notable part in your life.
That's a really searching question which nobody's asked before. I did write an account of an operation I took part in, which as my first book, The Road from Sarajevo, which is an account of 2nd Battalion of the Light Infantry's adventures in Bosnia in 1995-96. And I have put in the book, in a few occasions, some things that I did or had personal knowledge of that I felt added value and helped bring it to life. I mean, I'd have loved for the book to be twice as long, to have twice as many examples of people doing all the exciting stuff, showing great determination and imagination and initiative on operations. But it did make, I mean, the first thing is it made me think how lucky I'd been to serve in the army at that time, to travel so much, you know, to Hong Kong. I spent a fair share of my time in UK, Germany, Northern Ireland, but I also trained in France, Portugal, Canada on the wonderful Armoured Warfare Training Centre on the Prairie, which sadly is no more. Visited the United States 10 times on army duty. You know, spent a short time in Afghanistan, spent a very interesting time in Syria about 20 years ago. And I served with some fantastic people in my own regiment, the Light Infantry. I spent 18 months with the Royal Green Jackets, a year with the cavalry at Bovington. And wherever I met interesting and excellent people. I mean, I'll just bring it to life with one example. I went on a course to teach me to manage and look after the fleet of warrior armoured vehicles of the battalion I was about to command. And on that course were all the warrant officers of the Royal Highland Fusiliers. And they all came from Glasgow. And they all had the most amazing sense of humour. Mm-hmm. You know, any setback was a trigger for a joke. And they were constantly taking the mickey out of each other and everybody else around them, and had an amazing standard of banter. And it just made what could have been quite a dull and routine course a joy to be on, which I've never forgotten. And you know, the sense of humour of people throughout the army, there's a very special breed of people, which there are more of in the army than society, that when things get difficult and cold and wet and dangerous, it's actually a trigger for people's sense of humour. And perhaps I don't talk about that in the book as much as I should. I think though, that writing it and unearthing documents, many of which were previously classified, enabled me to join up the dots in a way that I couldn't do before. So if I were to take an example, in the Northern Ireland chapter, I set out to write about the intelligence element of the Northern Ireland campaign and also the role of special forces. And I found that not only are there some very credible memoirs that have been published, which the MOD has not sort of suppressed, but also you can now find credible documents through a bit of research about this. And if we take one example, I found the paper submitted to the Prime Minister in the early 70s, setting out how the initial experiments for covert operations in civilian clothes in Northern Ireland in the early 70s hadn't been as well organised as they could have been. I mean, there were some successes, but also some operators were ambushed by the IRA and killed. And it was decided to put it on a regular footing. So it became what was known as the Special Reconnaissance Unit and then various other names, which changed for security. And known as 14 Company, it had decisive effect alongside the human intelligence handlers of the intelligence corps, the special branch intelligence handlers, and the increasingly capable police covert forces. And all of this became a sort of joint integrated task force that conducted counter-terrorism operations amongst the people of Northern Ireland, but in a way that reduced the crashing and banging and inconveniencing the locals and kicking doors that had been so counterproductive earlier in the campaign. And that's a remarkable story of how this was developed, particularly the human intelligence people in the intelligence corps and the special operators of what was often known as 14 Company. And I was amazed that I was allowed to tell the story and could find all this primary and secondary source material that enabled me to set it out. Similarly, on Northern Ireland, I knew because I saw it going on that General Bagnall had conducted a very secret strategic review of Northern Ireland of the military strategy in the late 80s, which changed direction. I won't spill out the details now. But he did create the conditions for the army getting more advantage over terrorists in Northern Ireland in the early 90s, particularly through improved surveillance technology and the use of special forces, which I saw myself as a battalion second in command in 1992. And that was one of the very enjoyable parts of the book, being able to join up the dots in a way that I hadn't realised I was going to be able to.
Why is it I get the sense there's at least another book in you, Ben? It's been really good talking to you. And The Rise and Fall of the British Army, 1975 to 2025, is out now. Brigadier Ben Barry, great to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Defence Explained. This is SITREP.